This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Everyone, thanks for listening to the Western Hunting Hub podcast. In this episode, I have Dirk Stark on, a gentleman who's just been in the hunting industry for a while, kind of working in the background with various companies and things. Just ran into him on Instagram, and was really interested to chat with him on some various bow accessories. No, not really accessories, but strings and fletchings, veins, that sort of thing, because that's one of the companies it works with. But then we just started talking all about that, and then the Velvalock company, just all bow hunted related stuff, and was actually pleasantly surprised how much I learned and was interested in some of these products. So take a look at this. Some cool science being involved in the hunting gear world, and so all those advancements and things with American-made products, and some cool stuff. So check that out, and hope you enjoy. We got a one-hour episode of some good stuff. So hope you enjoy this episode with Dirk Stark. Thanks.
All right, thanks for coming on to the Western Hunting Podcast. If you wouldn't mind, real quick, just introduce yourself and kind of what, I guess you got a lot of irons in the fire, so I don't want to spend the whole time talking about that. I think we could definitely do that, but maybe just a little bit about yourself and then personally, and then we'll go into the introduction of what your business is about.
Sure. Thanks, Clint. My name's Dirk Stark. I live in Minnesota, but I hunt in South Dakota quite a bit. And that's kind of how Clint and I ended up kind of running over each other, is talking about antelope hunting in South Dakota. And actually a real good friend of mine that passed away that worked for Game Fish and Parks, Keith Winterstein. But I've been in the hunting industry about 30 years, started making turkey calls, wingbone calls, and doing seminars to Fleet Farm and Cabela's and Gander Mountain and stuff, like 30 years ago, and ended up, they got in the Shield stores, and then pretty soon I was doing stuff for the different conservation banquets and things like that, and got in the industry before there was internet. I did a video about being social on social. And talked about the days that, you know, today everyone says, look at me on Facebook, right? Instead of engaging like we used to do. We used to go to the archery shop, or we'd do something at the local gun club, or the Cub Scouts or Boy Scouts, and do little things like that, or at Fleet Farm or wherever. And that's how brands became social, and that's how hunters learned about stuff, because we didn't have the internet. And then came the internet, and then came MySpace.
Oh, sure.
Right? So I've been around a while, love the outdoors, and have, I guess, I have a hunting ranch in Western South Dakota as well. That's archery only. And it's great to have hunters all over the place come from there. I currently have a marketing company, and it's marketing, sales, product development, content creation for many different brands. So that's kind of as well how I end up reaching out to Clint too, because of looking at if he was familiar with some of the products that I work with.
Yeah. And I guess just on the hunting side of things, what what's your passion in the outdoors as far as, like, is it mule deer? Is it elk? Like, if you had to pick one of those, what's your stick?
I have a t-shirt that I made for the ranch. It says, if the arrows ain't flying, there ain't no dying. So
archery hunting, so, obviously.
Yeah. So anything archery. You know, I got started in archery at about age 8. I love to spear carp, and I was so small that the spear was too heavy for me. And so my grandpa bought me a bow for bow fishing. And, that's kind of how I got into it. I started shooting squirrels and chipmunks and everything else and got into it. And then eventually started making my own arrows and made my own camouflage before there was a real tree.
Should have got a patent behind that thing and you would have been all right.
Right. I remember Jim Crumley's tree bark camo when it came out. So I went to Fleet Farm and bought a gray pair of coveralls and took some black paint and started making my own tree bark. That was my first camel.
Oh, wow.
Back in the day. So,
good story.
Yeah. So lots of fun stuff. Lots of fun memories and, you know, just a lot of great, great, great people that I've met and, I've got to meet over the time and always, there's always more to learn and more new people to meet. So,
yeah, absolutely.
And that, you know, that's kind of how we got connected too, was Keith. Cause I bow hunted for antelope out in Western South Dakota for about 10 years, just on public ground, stomping around and Keith and I would hunt together. And we brought in, I brought in Ted Nugent. I brought in the keepers for one of their hunts, Mike Sieve. And so we always had someone and doing stuff with tourism and just a blast. And, but it was a lot of work for sure on that public ground. And so I'm very fortunate right now to have my own ground and bring people in and have a good time with that. So,
yeah. And now I'm sure you're kind of keeping tabs on things, but, because that's going to affect you, is South Dakota's proposal for limited non-resident archery tags.
Yeah, I've seen that, and I asked them about it, and my understanding on it so far is that it's for public ground.
Right, right.
They might differentiate that for private ground.
Unlimited for private, and this is still, like, proposed. So it's not, like, set in law yet, but... for private ground, for sure, it's unlimited in the proposal, and then on public ground is 2,200 non-resident.
Yeah, tags. Yeah. Which I see that many people. It seems like up in Harding County.
Oh, no kidding.
For non-residents.
And if anyone's wondering where that's at, that's Northwest South Dakota.
Right, right.
And for sure,
it's amazing. I'll be at the ranch there, and I'll see people from New York and West Virginia, and they've got campers. And I mean, that's what I did, you know, years ago. That's what I did, is hunted that public ground, and that's how I got hooked. And your success on public ground is, you know, less than 10% chance, you know. I mean, it's crazy, but it offers opportunity, and that's something Joel Maxfield and I talk about quite a bit back and forth about how South Dakota is changing things. I mean, here they have public ground, and then as non-residents, you can't hunt it until October 1, where if you hunt private ground, it's September 1, you know? And so he's like, hey, I pay taxes, federal taxes, just like everyone else. Why can't I hunt? So that's a huge controversy. And I it's just an interesting conversation, you know, and what is it about managing that can't be managed like other states, you know, to make that work out, like Kansas or Iowa or stuff like that do things differently. I'm obviously here in Minnesota, and I won't even get into how the DNR manages things here, but
yeah, right. Sure.
Right. But it's a hard thing. And I know obviously with your background, it's a really hard deal to do, except that I think the only way you can have is really open conversations with people about things like that.
Yeah, and I, you're never going to please everybody. There's always people that are upset about this and that, and you look at the end goal, and I know this is like a social management thing more than the wildlife. So you're managing hunters, so hunter satisfaction to try and control the number of people out there. And most of my listeners are actually from Colorado, Arizona, California. And those hunters, a lot of them are traveling to Colorado if they're not in Colorado.
Right.
Already. And that is an orange army for sure. And loaded with that. And I saw some clickbait and I didn't click on it. So I'll be, it's too early yet. So I did see something about end of OTC. So I'm curious to see what happens in Colorado over the next few years with the over-the-counter takes, because it's every year it seems like there's a new GMU that's not listed under the over-the-counter tag, but you still have increasing numbers of over-the-counter hunters going to less and less units. So it just makes sense to me that, well, if those are going to be continually limited, then how can you maintain an over-the-counter archery tag if there's less and less units in it?
So right.
A lot happening there in Colorado. I think that it'll be interesting to see.
And then also in your position, you know that hunter numbers seem to be going down and down and down. So that kind of throws me in a loop going, okay, if hunter numbers are going down, why does there seem to be more pressure on public grounds? You know, and I haven't quite figured out, because if the hunting numbers were going up, man, I love it, because we'd be selling a lot more hunting products.
Sure. Yeah. And it seems like overarching, like decrease, increase of hunters is a really, it doesn't make sense. But when you look at regionally different areas, I think that makes more sense. And then also you have people like myself, where I only hunted whatever state I lived in. And now it's, I hunted Minnesota last year.
Oh my gosh, you were one of the few non-residents that came over.
I did, and I shot a bear with my bow. It was
there you go, bear, there you go.
Yep. It was a good time. And so I was in there, Colorado, South Dakota. So only three states, and that's not even a lot compared to a lot of people. And then I hunted down in Texas just a month ago. So you've got people that are traveling, you're doing more hunts, and just increasing the number that they're doing. And I think that's what's showing that overcrowdedness. And then also on the public land piece of the trendiness of, I'm a DIY public land hunter. That I feel like has some pressure to put on, well, you're only really doing it the best way possible if you're doing it on public ground, which is great. I hunt 95% on public ground. Right. I love it. It's great. But I'm not going to turn away a 10,000 acre ranch if I can go hunt on it and still have the same experience. I just don't always like the 40 acre pieces or 100 acre pieces. Like, you can't hunt the deer. Those are always a little trickier, but Western hunting, Western style.
Yeah.
Now that's different with Eastern hunting in a tree stand, where you could hunt some public, and you still have to figure them out for sure. And you can hunt.
Yeah, but it's still tough. We've got 120 acres here. I hunt in Minnesota, and actually it's more for food plots and photography, and you know my business, right? But it's got some great deer. I mean, my neighbor shot a 196 and three quarter, and we've had a couple of 200. I'm right across the road from a 200-acre state park. So, that helps to have that. But in reality, I mean, during the rut, I mean, we're talking deer move 5 miles. You know, my neighbors way down the road, they get the same deer on camera as I do. And so, really, you're just pass shooting.
Yep.
And so, I mean, so you can try to pattern them, but really, in a scenario like that, you might pattern early season, but during the gun season, forget it. And so that's why I head out west, because then I don't have to deal with with that, because it's so it's frustrating when you, as a land manager, you take care of your land and you put out food plots and you make trails and you plant trees and put in water and all that kind of stuff. And then you realize, okay, well, there's someone that comes, you know, that comes hunts once a year for a day, and you know, they still have the tags and their orange stuff when they come out and shoot. And I'm like, okay, I get all defensive about it, but then I think, well, at least they came out.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. You know,
and they bought some hunting gear.
Yeah. And they bought some hunting gear. And so it's a start, because you know, I have to look, really take a step back. I mean, it's really easy for us hunters to get judgmental about that, but at some time we were all there. You know, we were all there, and we all had our stuff. And I remember, you know, deer hunting weekend was 2 days with my dad. And that was it.
Yeah.
Well, and I called myself a deer hunter. Yeah. Right. And now it's, you know, 100, 200 days a year we're working on stuff for deer.
Yeah, so, absolutely. And yeah, we don't need to get into a non-resident support kind of discussion, right. But you think about, like, just on my bear hunt to Minnesota, I'm pretty sure I dropped $1,000 pretty easily. Right. And I was, $1,000 is really what I spent. And it was just on fuel, tags, and I stayed at my brother's house. So I didn't even have a hotel. So it's easy to drop $2,000 on any hunt to the next state over, just because of the drive and the fuel. They got to go eat and all that. You're just helping bring some money into that economy. And here in South Dakota, in our rural little towns, that's important. We thrive off of those, like Buffalo in Harding County, Northwest South Dakota. Yeah. They thrive off of antelope hunters and archery hunters just going into their little restaurants and bars, having a drink and eating food. And
there isn't many bars and restaurants.
No.
There isn't many people there, right? Yeah.
You got to go there and support them.
Right. You know, I was at a SCI thing in Jackson Hole, and it was they have it's called American Wilderness Leadership School, and they bring in teachers and educators and politicians, and they teach them about gun safety. They certify them as an NASP instructor. They go through the economics of hunting, the politics of hunting, all that kind of stuff for a week-long class. And it's a really cool thing. If you ever get a chance, look up the American Wilderness Leadership School, and it's funded by Safari Club International. And what I saw, a lot of the educators were like superintendents and teachers coming out of Chicago and New York, and they were bringing back firearm stuff to their schools for firearm safety, you know, like a sim trainer in the classrooms and archery. And it was so exciting to be a part of that. But the economics of hunting is huge, huge, huge thing that I think sometimes we miss, as well as that we don't appreciate that, what that means, and taking care of our natural resources in an area. And I mean, South Dakota is great for that, because it has huge natural resources, and I understand you have to protect that, but also look at the economics of that. And I mean, look at a non-resident tag in Iowa. It's, you know, 3 years to get it, and it's almost $700. So obviously there's some value to that, that, right?
Yeah,
and no kidding. So I think there's different ways to do that as well. But those are all, I mean, we could have conversations upon conversations about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But
so let's shift gears to business side of things. What products do you currently have? Because I've got, especially around some archery things, I got some questions.
Yeah, you bet. So, you know, way back in the day, I launched Flying Arrow Archery, the Toxic Broadhead, with Chris Rager. I worked with Ben Stern, and we launched Tacticam before that blew up. What else? Oh, the first camo for Sitka was that Mountain Pattern. We did licensing for. So I've been around a lot and doing different things. For 7 years, I worked with Chinese manufacturer and designing tree stands, ground blinds, and ice fishing gear. And I parted ways because I really like Made in America.
Sure. Yeah.
So some of the companies I'm working with right now are A3 Strengths. They're out of Biola, Wisconsin. It's an interesting product. I'm lucky I get to choose brands I get to work with. because I'm always looking for unique things that make them differentiate them from competition. Work with Flex Fletch and Silentite Veins out of White Bear Lake, Minnesota. Do some stuff with Scree gear. What else I have? Optics company. Let's see, what else? Modern Spartan Systems Gun Oil Lubricant and Additive. I've got a fishing lure company called the Doomsday Turtle. I know I'm going to miss a bunch here, and it's going to kick me in the... Oh, I've got a new clothing company out of Minnesota that's official base layer for the NFL. And they've got a really cool heated technology that doesn't require batteries. So that's kind of cool. It's as soon as the material touches your skin, it starts warming up. So really
like a chemical reaction. This makes,
you know,
I know it's tough, but my science brain's like, well, you can't create energy. So yeah. Where is it coming from? But that's
There, it's something crazy on it. And I need to get in the science more of it, but it's literally at the SHOT Show, I put on a pair of their socks in my hand. It was like, it wasn't quite as hot as having a hot hands, you know, those little chemical bags, things that you put in your gloves or whatever. It wasn't quite as hot as that, but it was significant enough to go, wow, that's warming up and there's no batteries.
Oh, weird. Huh.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. I'll have to, what you need to do is you'll need to send me like your list of links or something. And maybe you did on Instagram, but
yeah.
And then I'll post them down below in the show notes.
Right.
But let's focus on just some strings. I got a new bow and I've just started putting some accessories on it. Got a new Hoyt Highline. That's the big boy bow. Cause that's what I have to have. And, it's so sweet. Paid the extra money just to have different colored limbs, but it was worth it. That's that wilderness green with the black limbs, and then everything else is just blacked out. And I can't wait to shoot it. I shot it at a Total Archery Challenge event, last year.
In Rapid?
At Terry Peak.
Peak. Yeah, we were there. Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, that I've done one of those also in the Sunlight one in Colorado, which was a great time. And then this was my second one. But me and my dad went, and he was bugging me again about going this next year, which is it was fun.
Right.
It was totally fun. Right. So on these new strings, or I guess just aftermarket strings, we get our new bows where we shoot them for a little while, and I know the bow shops say, oh, you got about 6 months to a year, maybe, or you've got a year and a half, maybe tops. I've never heard them say a year and a half to me, but always a year you got for the life of a string, and you just need to keep swapping them out is what it seems like. What's the difference between a factory string and some of these aftermarket strings? What's the difference?
Well, I just did a video on it, and actually I asked, are all bow strings created equal? And this isn't really about a brand that I'll say this. This is just about facts, right? So for the last 40 years on the market, there was basically everyone knows 452X. So 99% of all string makers use the same material called 452X. And that's a blend of fibers. And that blend is some of the fibers stretch and some are static. So it's just a blend of fibers. So really everyone's using pretty much the same string material, right? To start out with. So really there isn't a lot. Some the factory strings and some companies will use a little bit cheaper blend. And so you get more movement off of that than a other one. Some of the custom string makers do more on serving end loops or some other features, but just some minor things really that are different. It's really what I will just say is that it's 90% of it is marketing based on the bow strings. The company that I'm working with right now stands out completely different on that because they're using a completely different material and they have a completely different process. And so those two things to me stand out, and what I've learned about, I'm not a huge expert, but what I've seen is the science on that from people that using it, as well as some of the major bow companies now that are really interested in it. And instead of a blend of 452X, A3 Archery does make strings with 452X for people who want the kind of same old thing. But they also make some of their strings, their Bloodline, their Platinum Series, out of a Bloodline B99 fiber. And that fiber is not a blend. It's just a straight, pure Dyneema fiber. And that string has 32 strands on it versus 24 strands. And what you end up doing is you end up a rounder string, and it doesn't flatten out through your cams. It also is waxless. Okay, all the other strings are waxless, so you have to wax the strings or they get fuzzy, and because they're a blend, they end up wearing out. This fiber doesn't move. You put it on your string, and it's locked in. And part of that is this process that they use. They call it their pre-cycle technology. So think of us, most string companies, though, all string companies, they build their strings and they stretch them in a static stretch, about 450 to 500 pounds. And they just stretch them out, and then they tie them. And then when they take them off the pressure, then they have to be really careful so they don't unwind and everything else, right? Mm-hmm. If you've seen that, they come with paper clips on everything else. And A3 does an additional process on top of that they develop with computers and all this kind of stuff. And basically, they bring it up and bring the poundage up and down and up and down in a dynamic movement that actually with much higher poundages in it. And what that does is when you get your string from A3, the string actually looks like a stainless steel cable. It doesn't come unwound. I mean, you can get your peep in it, but the fibers are locked in like a stainless steel cable, you know, and with that, you can unpry them. And what that does is it takes out all the movement, all the voids and strings. And so it's a combination of the process and the material that make it really superior. I can take a shot in string. You know, someone says, hey, you do 200 or 300 shots, and now your string should be settled in, right? You shouldn't have any more timing issues. I can take that same string, run it through that process, and get another 1/4 inch to 5/16 inch movement out of that string.
Right.
Hmm. Right. So this has nothing to do with the brand. I mean, it's A3, but it's really about that I've learned is there's two things that are significantly different from A3 than all other string builders on there. They're using a different material and a different process. Okay. And there are some Bloodline fibers. People are using some Bloodline. Bloodline makes another blend that is similar to a 452X. So there are some string makers that say they use Bloodline, but it's really that 452X. The B99 is, because it's waxless, it's slipperier, it's harder to work with, harder to tie, and because of convenience and timing and things like that, and expense, that they don't choose that B99 fiber.
So on a regular, let's say, a not a cheaper made bow, but one that still has a little stretch to it, or even the factory string, because I guess I don't even know what I have on my bow or what Hoyt has or what Matthews had, because it's just whatever deals they have with string makers. You shoot that first 200-300 arrows or whatever, and you get that initial stretch out. Is there continued stretch throughout?
It's not really truly a stretch. It's a perceived stretch. It's actually movement, because there's voids that do come out eventually, and that's what you'll see when you keep shooting. You'll have to eventually retune your bow, you know, or change your peep a little bit. It'll creep a little bit. I mean, it's close, but it does move after time, and it will definitely affect things for longer range shots. You know, if you're shooting 20-30 yards, it's not going to be that big a deal, but if you do longer range shots and speed, like, and we've taken these strings, the Bloodline fiber ones and the Platinum, and put them on a bow on a new Bowtech and got another 12 feet per second off of it.
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com. Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
When I ask people, what is really different about your string versus anyone else's? And there's just crickets.
Yeah.
But when I can say, here's what's different. It's a different fiber, completely different fiber. It's not a blend. It's not waxless. Or if it is waxless, it's abrasion resistant and water resistant. And it'll make your bow shoot faster. There's more strands in it.
Right? Sure.
The list just goes on and on and on and on that I can say, this is actually the facts. It's not just because it's cooler, it's got a better color, or I'm a pro staff or stuff like that. So that's what I really, really appreciate about when I can get behind a brand like that, when there's actual something that's different.
Yeah.
Because it's a different material and, again, a different process, and they're going to pick up speed. The durability, we have some tournament shooters, you know, if you're a tournament shooter, or even, example, Ralph and Vicky are good friends. So they're like, man, I change my bow strings at least 3 times a year.
I can't.
For all the shooting they do.
I can't do that. I mean, once I feel right. confident in my bow, I just don't want to touch it.
Right, exactly. Who likes to change their bow strings and who likes to fletch arrows, right?
Exactly. Right. You get, I like sticking with what works and just going with it. I mean, this is a first bow for me since 2017, which is not that old for a lot of people, but it's new bow. It'll take a little while to get comfortable with it, but I couldn't do a new bow every year. I couldn't.
No.
That's not how I work.
Yeah, right. It's kind of like your cuddly blanket or your black lab, right?
Oh, yeah.
You just can't. Yeah. Or your Ford truck, right?
But, yeah. Oh, but I think sure. That's connected.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Yeah. So I think that's what's unique. So if the tournament shooter is getting 3 years out of their strings at a high level ASA shooter, if they're getting 3 years out of it, imagine what average Joe bow hunter like us. I mean, it's going to last as long as our bow is going to last, and we're going to keep it, and it's not going to move. So that's what I saw again, I'm not the best archer in the world, but what I noticed is the more I shoot or used to shoot, you know, with different strings on it, is that God, I have to always change my pins or always tweaking with something. I'm like, what is going on?
Yeah.
And that's what I realized, is that there was just this natural movement over time. And the more you shoot, the more it does. And if it's a wax string, if you're not waxing it. What I also learned about it is that if, let's say you set up your bow in July, right? Because that's when you're really getting out and getting ready for the archery season. You're getting it set up and you've got a string that you wax. But come December or January, you're hunting. Your timing is going to be off because that wax is going to change how your bow shoots.
Hmm. Another thing I just thought of too is we've been caught in snowstorms and nobody that totally missed a deer just because of the rain down in Arizona that just hit and as he shot just that water just blew up.
Right.
And his arrow just died.
Right.
So that would be a huge factor of like, well, doesn't matter if it's raining or.
Right.
I mean, there's
water resistant.
It's still got to be a little bit of factors there to play because you've got added weight to a string. It just water on it or in your bow and whatever else. Probably a little factor. But if you can remove that factor of a string soaking up a bunch of moisture, that's probably huge.
Well, and think about how many, I mean, I've asked people, how often do you wax your string? Some people, it's like every time I shoot, I look at it, right? Other people, it's once a year. Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to have varied degrees that your string is drying out on you. And so it is going to, it's going to shoot differently all the time if it's not consistent.
Very interesting.
So interesting, cool stuff.
That's an area I don't know much about, and now I feel a little bit more educated. So that's good stuff. Yeah. Let's move on to the fletchings and veins that the company over in White Bear, what they have and got going on, because that's an arrow that or an arrow. That's a thing that I also don't feel confident in is matching my arrow setup vein wise to get that quality arrow flight. So what do they have going on over there?
Right. So again, I'll just preface this in saying I'm not an expert. Okay, I'm not one of those guys that has to do 500 push-ups before he shoots his bow kind of thing.
Sure.
you know what I'm talking about, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right? Or shooting 150 yards. But I ran into Flex Fletch probably 3 years ago at the ATA show. And I said, you know, I've been in the industry a long time. Where are you guys from? And they said, Minnesota. And I said, what? No, you're not. And so the story went around and really – Flex Fletch was the first non-feathered vein on the market in 1970. If they would have been had a really good patent attorney, they would have owned the market because they didn't patent their design. They didn't patent that it was a non-feathered vein, you know? And if they would have, they would own the industry. They also came out with the first glue as well. So if you know the boning, won't even get into that story, but anyway. So they have a product called Flex Bond, right? And it's Boney's recipe is the same exactly as Flex Bond, and our that one came out of on the market in 1970. So that's kind of been the standard glue for a long time before Siren Acrylite Super Glue came on the market. But anyway, so Flex Fletch is kind of pretty cool because as I dug into it more, I'm like, what is this company that's been around for 50 years? And I've never heard about it. So, because I'm not a Target guy, right? And so, but what I learned is that 90% of their sales are international. I started digging into it more, and I found out the Korean national team, that's the only vein that they shoot. I found out the Netherlands national team, that's the only vein they shoot. The Colombian national team, it's the only vein that they shoot. I'm like, okay. So then I've got Sarah Lopez. I think she's 8 or 9-time world champion. Mike Schlosser, same thing. They're using our veins and have been offered tens of thousands of dollars from other folks. And they're like, we're not switching. So as an American guy who likes to sell things, I'm going, okay, what are these guys getting paid? And they're not. They're just, why are they making that choice? So I found out more about it is that, again, here's a company that has a different material and a different process than everything else. Most veins in the market, and I just thought this, right? Everyone knows the boning blazer, right? And or AE or tack or vein tech. All of those veins are melted plastic and they're extruded like just like a tube of toothpaste. They're just extruded through a thing. If you look at them, they all have straight walls. And so Flex Fletch does things differently. They actually blend their own polyurethanes together on site in White Bear Lake. Most of their veins are a 2-part polyurethane, the Silent Night, a little bit different. That's a 3-part polyurethane. They mold them in these molds and into strips, and they're tapered from the base to the edge of the vein. So it was actually designed by an aeronautic engineer instead of just, we all think, oh, it's just the shield cut or just the parabolic cut and that's it. But instead of just the side profile, they looked at it as a straight on profile, like a wing, and made them thinner and tapered. Just more aerodynamic. The polyurethane has a different different characteristic to it. But the biggest thing is that, that people love is that it's super, super tough. Those 3D and ASA shooters and target archers around the world that I've interviewed, I mean, they're stacking arrows in over and over and over, and they're not getting tears. I mean, like I said, who hates to refletch arrows, right? If you haven't refletched it because your veins are tearing, I hate it, right?
Or I hit a soft spot of the target, and it goes in. And
right.
And I have to pull it out, and I get a little wavy vein tear.
Right.
So
think about that. If it's melted plastic, I think about like a milk carton. If you bend over a milk carton, you get a crease in it, right? and you can heat it back up, but you've got a weak spot in it now. For these vanes, actually, we buried them into a target, left them into a target for months, pulled them out. Within 10 minutes, they come back to shape on their own. So it's a different material that has different characteristics. So it's tougher. It comes back to shape on its own. If you don't like the fletch, you put them on. Ryan Jeffries, who just took second place this summer behind Levi Morgan, Ryan pulled out a set of arrows he had from 20 years ago, brought them to the ATA show, and he said, "How old do you think these vanes are?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "They're 20 years old."
Wow.
He said, "I shot them for 3 years competitive and target, and now they're just kind of in the garage, but literally they look like new."
So durability is really what, and then I guess the aerodynamics piece of that on.
Right. Got right. It.
So I'm looking at those Silent Night ones, and profile-wise, you compare them to a AAE Max. Like, length-wise, are they about the same? Height-wise, are they about the same?
They're close. They're pretty close, except you're looking at when you're dealing with FOC, because our vanes are thinner and tapered, they're a lot less weight.
Oh.
So FOC change is a big deal on it. So think about this. I'm just going next to like a Blazer 2-inch, right?
Yeah.
Our 3-inch vanes are less than a Blazer 2-inch.
Okay. So you're... right? Yeah. So thinner, it's almost like you've got a more of a controlled bear shaft then. Because you have less wind resistance there. You have... still the control of that arrow,
right?
Because it's going to grab. It's still there. It's not right. It's not there. And then the durability. Well, I don't want to go fletching more arrows now.
Right.
But I'm an easy sell.
Right. So I'll you know, some of the skeptics out there said, "Oh, flex fletch, you know, they're harder to fletch, or they had adhesion issues, things like that, or you had to do all this prep." Well, about 5 years ago, they switched from, because they're molded, you have to have a mold release, right? Instead of extruded, where you're just ripping them out. So they had a mold release that they switched to a water base that evaporates, and then they wash them now. Actually, it's like a wash machine. They actually wash all the vanes before they go out, so that literally you can use any glue on them now. You don't have to prep them.
No,
we sell a primer pen, but I should say that we should use it, but I don't.
I don't. Gluing on wraps are no big deal.
No, it's not. And what's interesting is that with a thinner base, they're much more flexible. And we've had people put a 5-degree helical using a vane tack on them. I'm like, holy smokes. You know, you're going to put a major parachute on them with a 4-fletched 5-degree helical, but it can be done because it's a very flexible vane. In fact, that's the other cool thing. We did a stretch test, and you could take this and just do this with your vanes. Is, you know, if you've got some extra vanes laying around, take one of the Silent Night or the Flex Fletch vanes, put it in a vise and grab a hold of it with a plier, and pull it out about 4 or 5 inches, right? Do that with one of your other vanes, it'll tear. Flex fletch, that theirs will come back to shape on their own after you stretch it out like that.
Is there any certain wraps that work better with those vanes? Because I had someone tell me once, actually John Dudley told me once, that not all wraps are created equal. And
oh yeah,
because I asked him that question, and then I got no context after that because it was just in passing at a total archery shoot. So
I haven't, using these vanes now, I haven't found that there's an issue. Obviously wraps are nice because if you want to switch colors, the wraps make it come off cleaner and easier than without. But I personally, again, I'm average Joe Archer that I use wraps on some of my stuff for making them pretty, and others I don't. And I really haven't seen any difference either way.
Okay. Well, very cool.
But glue is the biggest thing that most people don't know. If you're using a Siren Acrylide Super Glue, you know, you've got about a month with that after you open it up once. And some people are like, what? I didn't know that. And that's, if they're having adhesion issues, most likely they have old glue.
Oh. Hmm. Which I have had. I had some adhesion issues last year with some some arrows, and I was like, I'm not doing anything wrong here. So maybe it was just old glue.
So one thing to look at is in like a plastic, like the Loctite super glue stuff, right? In a plastic bottle like that, or any plastic bottles, plastic actually breathes and oxygen can get in it and actually make the glue bad. So once that seal's broke on it, your glues will last much longer in glass, or like with ours are actually foil tubes.
Hmm. Okay. So you guys definitely would recommend your adhesive.
Sure.
Okay. Yes.
Sure.
Good answer.
How's that for a salesman?
Yeah. It's not bad. Go with ours. But really, because that's a big sale point for people, is that it's, you don't have to. I mean, we got it, but you don't have to. You have whatever you have, as long as it's, I guess, newer glue or.
Yeah, there are other companies that say, oh, you have to use their glue and their primer, and that's the only way it's going to work. Well, it may be because of how their vein is, or it could be because they just want to sell more of their own stuff. But I'm just going to tell you that with ours, you don't need to.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to move on to the last product that is totally different, but has me very intrigued. And I know it works. I've seen it work. But the Velvalock.
Sure.
I mean, we didn't even mention that, but I was just flipping through an old Instagram DM there and saw, oh yeah, Velvalock. I mean, we've looked at that for, I was going to get some for just when I take people out hunting early season, just to have it. So it's there and ready to roll. It blows my mind that you can just spray it on there and it's good to go. Like I've seen it work on a big 370-inch bull, took four bottles of it, but because you got to douse it. What is that stuff? How does that work?
Yeah, it's crazy. So Velvet Antler Technologies is the name of the company, and here's another company that has something really unique that I had to be a part of. And so the original product was Velvalock, and so Daryl was hunting, you know, up in Idaho is where he's at, and he was getting just flies on, getting in his velvet like crazy. He was like, this is crazy. I got to figure out something. So he did. I can't tell you what's in it because I signed an NDA, but basically it's something that keeps the bugs off for starters, and keeps them from getting into it. But it also will dry the velvet out and you know, you do have to saturate it, and you can see at the saturation point, kind of like a sponge, when you spray something into a sponge, because that's what really velvet is that you can see where it's really wet or where it's just kind of surface wet. And as you do that, you can see it move. And what happens is you spray that in there, saturate it in, and set it out for about 36 hours outside in the sun. Okay, so that's the big thing. It really needs UV to activate it. And what that does is it sucks and pushes the blood out of the velvet through the pedicles. And if we've seen pictures of it or whatever, it looks just like the skull is bleeding because all that stuff has came out of the pedicles. The only time that it doesn't work and we have issues, people say, oh, that didn't work for this. I shot this big, you know, 200 crazy thing. It's got a crazy drop time or they put it upside down, is that you always have to think about gravity. So if there's something in that rack, then when you have it tines up, that there's just going to be a spot that doesn't drain out the pedicle, then you have to put a syringe in there and let it drain out of that spot.
Oh.
You know, yeah, or people will, their usual thing is they get a buck and they take off the skull cap and they hang it upside down in their garage. Well, nothing is going to drain out there because it needs to be tines up and drain out the pedicle. So that's the only time that there's ever had issues.
So you got that big bulbous drop tine coming down. You're literally just sticking a syringe in it so that blood has a place to go?
Yep, like a big 8-gauge or 10-gauge syringe and put that in there and open it up, and just it acts just like a shunt.
Huh. That's fascinating.
And what's crazy about it is that, so this replaces formaldehyde, right, or freeze drying. And if you've ever had a formaldehyde buck or a freeze dried buck, you have to be pretty careful with it afterwards. You know, it's like that velvet, oh, I can't touch it. But with this product, it's, I mean, Daryl's got one of a mule deer he brings to the shows that he did 20 years ago in the velvet. And people are rubbing up and down just like a leather glove on it. And it's super, super durable.
Huh. Because I hate the look of fake velvet. I hate it. I don't even bow hunt until deer are hard horned. It's not, I'm the odd guy out here. I don't want a velvet animal. And part of it is because of, the stripping and the this and that.
Right.
And also there's something about just, I think of a big burly necked mule deer that's hard horned and chocolate. Hard-horned. I mean, I can't,
right.
You can't beat a chocolate horned anything.
Right. Right. Right.
But, and many people would disagree. There's something about the velvet that's addicting. I'm not team velvet, but I would,
right.
I can't just not hunt during that time. I'm going right. to have to eventually here or, cause they're so patternable,
right.
during that time,
it's hard to pass it up.
I would love to do some of that early season mule deer out in the plains here and those bucks that are all in their big bachelor groups. That'd be a good time. But,
right.
That whole of what do I do with it now is a right. problem. Is there a shelf life on that? So like, can a hunter buy some, bring it along on every hunt and he's good for a couple of years, or is this a,
oh yeah, no, you're good to go. You're good to go.
Okay.
That's you're good, good to know. Yeah. So, and then the other cool thing is, did you see the hide lock?
No, explain.
So a hide lock is, so let's say you have a nice animal and you keep it out in the field and you're like, okay, I got to roll this up and I got to get it to, I got to get it in a cooler or something like that to keep bugs off it. Or you kill an elk up in the backcountry and you're like, oh, what do I do? How do I got to save this cape, right? Or you kill a bear, right? Up in the, way back in the country, or a goat or a sheep. And you're like, it's just a nightmare. What do I got to do? Do I got to haul salt up? You know, all that kind of stuff and plan ahead. Where this hide lock stuff is another crazy thing is that literally you flush it out, cut off all the extra fat and meat off the hide or the cape, then spray this on the skin side, not on the fur side. And what it does is it actually tightens up the pores and holds the hair in so you don't have hair loss. So think about antelope, you know, sure. I mean, they're notorious for hair loss. So you spray this on, it holds that in there. It also prevents it. Well, here's an example. So we took a chunk of antelope hide and we cut in two parts, threw one in a garbage bag and just as is. And we sprayed the other one with hide lock, threw it in the garbage bag and threw it in the horse trailer for a week. Okay. We brought it out and actually, what's his name from, he's got about a 14-year-old kid now, has his own clothing style. What's his name? Not Carlos. Anyway, he did this as well with his dad, and he pulls the one out and is like, oh my God, I can't even, there's bugs in it, maggots, everything else after a week. And he's like, okay, the other one was like, smells just fine. And it basically preserves it and keeps it from decomposing.
Huh. So
it doesn't tan it, but yeah. It stops it from decomposing, stops it from bugs getting into it. Bugs don't like this stuff. And so you don't have to refrigerate. You don't have to freeze your capes, your hides, anything like that. And literally you're carrying around a bottle or maybe two bottles instead of 10, 20 pounds of salt.
Yeah. And then so you're just pulling off some extra hunks of meat off of there. You're not doing a full fleshing job because that's not realistic either
right.
in the field.
No. And you can see the videos that it's literally, you know, taking off the chunks of meat and get it down there. As long as you can get it down to the – where the hide is getting into that, where you have exposure of this product to get it soak into the hide and it holds the hair on it. So it's pretty crazy what it does. And then the other product he has is another one to keep bugs out called Trophy Clean. So all your mounts, you know, once or twice a year, you spray down your mounts, wipe them down with this stuff. it takes all the grease and oil off of it, but then also prevents and kills any bugs, mites, any of that kind of stuff, eggs that are in it that have been laid in it, kills that and keeps them away. I talk with like Nate Hosey and Randy Birdsong at Headhunters. They lost 12 months to moss. Well, yeah. That's not a cheap deal.
No.
And, I mean, a lot of people have losing that, or you see a little bit of hair loss along the edges. They really come in like on whitetail, an elk from the backside, or mule deer from the backside, you know, where that board is, and they get in that side and they start working up on the edges. Man, it's crazy. Or in ears too. That's another spot that they get and start doing some damage. And literally, twice a year, if you clean your mount down, wipe it down, now you're protected from bugs.
Because I buy and sell taxidermy as my side business. Oh, and I just bought some insecticide thing, whatever, to spray stuff down. But if there was something specifically meant for that, I'm buying that. I'm getting some of that. Because that's always a concern. I get animals with bugs in. And so I get concerned about...
You bring them in your house, you rest your mounts, you'll get them.
Exactly. So I have a separate place for where I store my mounts, but they're going in an area with other mounts, like a whole bunch of them, of money worth of mounts. So I treat them.
Do you have any turkeys or deer mounts? I mean, turkeys or duck mounts?
No, I don't. Because you can't buy and sell waterfowl, and I don't ever have any of that. I've had turkey,
but they're notorious for getting birds are notorious for getting mites because they already carry them.
Oh,
you
know,
yeah. And so this product works fantastic on that. And then we took that and actually modified it to a new product called Fanlock. So if you kill a turkey in the field, you actually spray this on, saturate the fan, spread it out, and spray it every couple days for 5 days. And any fat or meat or whatever that's in that tail, it basically dries it up into almost like a plastic. It's crazy. And it kills all the mites and bugs and keeps them away, as well as, like, let's say you got a really cool spurs on a bird and you want to preserve the feet. Well, you spray this in there or eject it in the feet, whatever you want to do on it, and saturate those feet, and it preserves those feet and keeps the bugs off your feet, your fans, all that stuff.
Which product is that? The Trophy Clean?
That's called Fanlock.
Oh, because I'm looking at the – is that one separate on the –
Yeah, they're all different. There's fan lock, hide lock.
Oh, view all. Just got to view all, and I'll see them. There it is. Which is
Trophy Clean.
Your timing.
Then they've got Bone Bright for doing Euros and taking the grease out of them.
Your timing is unbelievable. I'm teaching a turkey fan taxidermy class tonight.
Right. Well, think about that. All the borax you have to use or stuff. And what that does is it just dries it out. It doesn't keep the bugs out of it.
Yeah. And I'll have to check out this other whitening stuff. I have a African lion skull that is kind of greasy yet. And whenever you get that grease stuff, it's just a mess. But
yeah,
looks like you got
sucks that grease out. So it's really cool. So what I think about this is that we changed all these products in the past. Last year were called like Velva Clean, Velva this, Velva that. I'm like, hold on. Most of these products are not about velvet.
Right.
You know, let's name them for what they're supposed to be named for. Like the stain scrub, that's pretty cool. You got a deer out, you're full of blood. Even if you don't get time to wash it right away and dries up, you spray that stain scrub on, and literally you can take a wet washcloth and wipe that dried stuff right off.
Just like trying to get the blood off antlers without taking the brown off.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yep, exactly. That works great on that as well.
Oh, I see.
Just so, or
game
like
bags,
the, or,
packs.
Yeah, I mean, and their head hauler is pretty cool. So, again, another small company out of Idaho with some really cool innovation, and there's nothing else like it on the market. So it's really easy for me to get behind. You know, we talk about it as from the field to the family room. There's a whole line of products for taking care of your trophies from the field to the family room.
Yeah. Well, my goodness, I didn't know there was that entire product line. I'm on their website now, just looking at all that stuff. That's pretty sweet.
Again, it's great about the product and stuff, but I think it's a really helpful tool for hunters, and that's anytime I can get behind a brand that has something that can help us and make us be better or keep our gear longer or whatever and make your time feel better, it's an easy sell then for people, because it's not about a name. It's really about making something that actually does a difference.
Wow. And all American made
right
products.
Right.
So stuff made there in Idaho, right there in White Bear Lake, yeah. Minnesota.
Yeah. Right.
And A3 is out of where?
They're out of Biola, Wisconsin. They used to be out of Washington, and they moved to Wisconsin.
Well, very cool. And yeah. I know our hunting community listeners appreciate that, enjoy that as well. As you see, not buying stuff at Walmart. I was literally talking to the owner of Coltech yesterday. Or this weekend, because he was at a show I was at, and he's a buddy of mine, and he just was talking about, people don't get it. Some people don't get it, that the Walmart junk, that stuff is not, we're not selling there. We're making high quality right. stuff. And he was just airing some grievances on a particular outdoor show that's what they had a lot of booths there that were just all of that kind of stuff. And he's like, he'd just gone to the outdoor expo in Utah. I said, that is a place to be. That is all the right. same like-minded people that want to have that quality right. gear. And we're, as hunters, right. we're willing to pay for it. I am so glad I dropped what I did on a good pack and what I,
right.
yeah, on good boots. Call me a snob, right. snob now, because I used to hunt in blue jeans, but I don't hunt in blue jeans anymore, and my school backpack. I don't want to.
Right.
I like quality gear, and that's why I nerd out about all this sort of thing, because something new, innovative, that's not just a remake of an existing thing.
Right. You know a company out of Idaho called Scree?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, they've got a lifetime warranty on their gear.
Yeah,
I mean, how many clothing companies have a lifetime warranty?
Well, if that were the case, I've got about three pairs of pants with zipper issues.
Right. So they're great about that. I use their stuff at the ranch all the time, because it's so I call it the Carhartt of Camel, and they're not really truly a client of mine. I just use it because I'm constantly burning through stuff, you know, Kryptek or other stuff. And
I thought they were in Colorado.
Scree?
Yeah.
I can think about it. I thought they were in Idaho or Utah. Huh. I have a couple different clients. I think they're in Utah, actually.
Huh. Yeah, there was because I had messaged back and forth early on in, my podcast stuff, and that was, I thought sure. they were in Colorado, but I mean, their phone number is 435, so
yeah,
that's not Colorado, Western Colorado, but interesting. Well, very cool. That'll wrap up our podcast, and
wow.
gave us some money to go spend, but I learned a bunch there, and hopefully listeners learned a bunch. If you got anything you want to plug quick, or to follow, maybe find that YouTube video on All Strings Aren't Created Equal or anything like that,
yeah.
do it now.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, I it's usually on the A3 page is where that is. But literally, I appreciate the time. It's always a good thing to visit, and I appreciate it. Hopefully we can share camp together sometime.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I love the Northwest part of the state, and there's a lot of opportunity up there. So, yeah, I want to thank you again, Dirk, for reaching out and connecting. Like you said earlier, it's fun. There's always more and more people to connect with. You never know who's out there. So thanks again for coming on, and we'll post all this stuff below for links for people to go check out.
Thanks, Clint. Have a good one.
All right. To the land, but it ain't my ground. This is God's
country. Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.